What do you do if you're a struggling artist in search of recognition? Well, if you're Lynn Hirschman Leeson, you write reviews of your own work under pseudonyms and get them published in the newspaper. For more than 30 years, Hirschman Leeson has created pioneering artwork in various media, including photography, performance art, video, film, web-based work, and interactive sculpture. Her groundbreaking art explores issues of reality and identity, and it's chronicled in the new book, The Art and Films of Lynn Hirschman Leeson, Secret Agents, Private Eye. Anne Strainshams talked to Lynn Hirschman Leeson about her diverse art, starting with her 1986 work, Confessions of a Chameleon, from the video series, The Electronic Diaries.
So when I was small, when I was little, and there would be these kinds of episodes of battering, I would go up to my attic and almost retreat into myself. And I would create these characters, each of which had their own life.
You made a series of videos called The Electronic Diaries in 1986, mm-hmm. and part one is called Confessions of a Chameleon. Now, in mm-hmm. this video, you say that you were abused as a child. Was that true?
Yes.
And is that part of, I mean, do you think that that abuse shaped your interest in self, real self, fictional selves?
I don't think it's ever one thing. I think that, you know, we come to our interest through a number of collisions with real life, and it's all of the things that we encompass in our experience. So certainly everything that we encounter has some resonance in what we become and therefore what we produce as kind of reflections of ourselves.
I guess what I'm curious about with that the Electronic Diaries project is I can't quite tell as a viewer, and I think viewers really aren't meant to be able to tell how much of it is a truthful diary and how much mm-hmm. of it is a portrait of a fictional character that you're making up.
Most of it is truthful, and I think because it's so deeply honest that people presume it's fictional.
I mean, you say you went to college at age 8.
Yeah, I did.
You did?
Yeah. See what I mean?
How did that happen?
Well, they had a special program that I was in Cleveland, and they took some students and had them go to Case Western Reserve for a short time. It was called Major Work at the time, and, you know, they just selected out a number of people to be part of this experimental project.
So were you a child prodigy?
I wouldn't say that, but, you know, they were experimenting with people that tested certain ways on these levels. So,
and did you have the whole college experience? I mean, you went to college with all the other...
No, I didn't get a degree. You know, it was just a short experimental thing. I was in it from fourth to sixth grade, and I went to the college classes one summer.
Did you have a major?
French.
We have to explain that because I can hear listeners thinking, wait, what, you had a fictional character you were living out as? This is, you're talking about Roberta Brightman, right? Your kind of fictional
Roberta
alter.
Brightmore.
Yeah. Roberta uh-huh. Brightmore, your fictional alter ego.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about her.
Well, in the early 70s, I had an exhibition at the University Art Museum that had sound in it. And the museum closed the show because they said sound wasn't art, media wasn't art, it didn't belong in a museum. So I thought, well, I can make these environments anywhere. Who needs a museum to show them? And I set up with Eleanor Coppola these rooms in a kind of transient hotel. And you were able to go in there 24 hours a day and kind of visit and trespass this room of a presumed identity. The person wasn't there, but all the artifacts of her life was. And that gave birth to the idea of creating a fictional identity that could live in real time, in real life. And therefore, I created this character named Roberta Brightmore, who was kind of modeled after Joyce Carol Oates' heroine in a story, a short story, of a woman who looked for stars and would write these letters to them. And so this fictional character began by looking for a roommate and going out on various adventures. And she lived quite a while keeping a trail and record of all the things that she experienced in her life. And she became a mirror of the culture that she lived in. I mean, she reflected back all the things that were part of living during that time and what it was like for a single woman and blonde single woman to experience life on the terms that she met it.
So what did you do to create Roberta? You said she's blonde. You're not.
I'm not. I mean, she looked different than I do. You know, she dressed different than I did. She had her own handwriting. She had her own language, her way of talking, her way of relating to people. She had her own clothing. And so it was a matter of really objectifying a personality, separating it from me and understanding what that particular person would do and how they would react and kind of living that out as a means of really studying identity. I mean, you have to understand that art up to that time, especially art that dealt with women, women's art had no history. It really was written out of the history books. And a lot of women were creating histories, even fictional histories of themselves, in order to kind of create some sort of a beginning of historical stability. So there were women really separately, not even knowing about each other, creating characters, pre-Cindy Sherman, as Cupid dolls, as waitresses, as kings, all over the country. But Roberta was the most enduring in that she lasted as long as she did and went into as much depth. I mean, she saw a psychiatrist, and I really, really outlined, you know, all the details of defining what a personality meant.
Wait, so she saw a psychiatrist. So you went to a psychiatrist in character as Roberta?
Yes. Roberta went. She was different from me. She had different problems than I did.
Was that ever confusing?
Yes. And in fact, that's why we started the multiples, because after a while, Roberta started to have really negative experience, and I thought maybe I was projecting something onto her. So I hired three people to go out as her, who dressed like her, who looked like her, who had her makeup.
At the same time?
Yeah.
So you made Roberta clones?
Yes, multiples, I called them in those days, but they really were clones.
What kind of negative experiences did she have?
Well, she would answer ads for a roommate, for instance. And in one episode of her Meet Mr. America series, she answered an ad, and it was really a prostitution ring that was trying to encourage her to join it.
How did she or you escape from the prostitution ring? Did you ever feel at risk yourself, personally?
Yes, always. And in fact, I had a photographer who would take surveillance photographs of these episodes, which I used to document her afterwards. And he was frightened and ran off. So Roberta had to go into the ladies' room and become Lynn, you know, take off the wig and makeup, and they didn't recognize me when I left. So they were looking for the blonde.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger of confusing yourself and Roberta?
No, because Roberta was, you know, fairly objectified, you know, and when in character as Roberta, you know, I was always aware of that.
What did your friends and family think of this? I mean, did they?
Well, nobody understood that piece. I have to say, you know, a lot of people thought I was schizophrenic. Not very many people knew about it when it was going on because they never publicized it or exhibited it till it was over. But, you know, my daughter thought it was weird.
How old was she at the time?
She was 11.
I can imagine that would be really unnerving.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can't really explain that it's an artwork. Nobody takes your word for it. But it took 25 years or so for it to really be historified and people to understand, you know, how predictive this was of kind of future works that would happen in our culture.
Mm-hmm. So how established did Roberta's life get? How real did she become?
Well, she was able to get credit cards when I couldn't. So she was, I mean, if one were to go back to that point in time, she would have more of a record than I did at that time. But she did get a driver's license, you know, had a checking account, was able to establish credit cards and take temporary jobs and have her own apartment.
She had an apartment?
Yeah.
So you rented her an apartment?
Yes. Hmm. And clothing and makeup and all of that, that kind of defines what a person is.
What happened to Roberta?
Roberta was finally exorcised in Lucrezia Borgia's crypt in Italy in 1979. Lucrezia Borgia's crypt became the Museum of Modern Art in Ferrara, Italy. And that seemed an appropriate place to have her exorcism. And the multiples went there for the exhibition. There was an exhibition of Roberta, and the multiples went there and performed the exorcism and, you know, took her photograph and burnt it. So, you know, she turned into ash and roses like the phoenix into the next artwork.
Well, since then, you've moved on into new media and especially into technology. How has technology, do you think, affected the way you create art that deals with identity?
Well, you know, there are a lot of the same ideas that were in the early hotel rooms or Roberta. Roberta I saw as an interactive vehicle, you know, that had kind of this random memory. And technology just made those early ideas more accessible. I mean, after Roberta, I made a piece which is credited as being the first interactive video disc that an artist made, you know, using computers in this way to create an artwork. And that was about a woman who was afraid to leave her home, unlike Roberta, who left her home all the time. And one used a remote switch and could control the character's life and decisions by just using this remote. But as new technology develops, it kind of inspires new works that talk about our culture at that particular time. I have a piece called Cynthia, which is a woman who responds through varying behaviors to the changes in the stock market. The market goes up, she dances and goes shopping. If it goes down, she takes a gun to her head and starts drinking. And this I see as a cultural portrait of how our behavior is linked to the economics or our economic index, you know, personal economic index. And the works, you know, the new robot works too, you know, are dealing with more collective memory. And when they're tied to an internet, as is this latest robot called Dina, you know, it recalls the entire information of the internet. So it becomes a real piece of connectivity rather than singularity or singular individuation or personality. It becomes a personality of everybody that's live and wired. So
with some of your more recent works, no one person is having to anymore act out one of your fictional characters. I mean, here you've got this robot, Dina, who lives and breathes. Well, not breathes.
Well, I mean, she pulsates.
Tell me about Dina.
Well, I made a film called Technolust 3 years ago. And in it, there were three self-replicating automatons.
Loneliness lives on our net frontier. Even motherboards and flash require touch. Think of passion each time you click me into you. E-dream with me before you crash.
And I wanted to create both this character online that people could interact with and have it as a distributed media system as well as a linear one on a film. Well, she gestated this robot, and now there's a new one called Dina. And Dina's connected to the internet. She has voice synthesis and speech recognition, and you can go up to her and talk to her.
Do you believe in God?
Yes, I do believe in God. In fact, I speak with her frequently.
And she has mood swings and reacts to you in different ways. You can go to her 2 months later and she'll remember you. And she kind of feeds off of the interaction of people, very much in a sense like Roberta, but kind of updated to what technology will allow or what we've invented for technology, which many times we do. We kind of invent these things before there is the technological component. And by the time we finish, you know, it's readily accessible and what we've done is obsolete.
So as an artist, you're really right on the cutting edge of media, of new media, then new technology. I mean, have you wanted to do things and people have said, no, no, we don't have the technology to do that yet?
It's not just technology. I want to do things all the time and people say I can't. So you have to find a way to do it, you know, one way or another. But the thing I like about technology and new media is that it is precisely that it has no history. And when you work with things with no history, you really can create their future. You know, maybe that's, you know, going back to the whole Roberta days of dealing with an issue that had no history and kind of redefining what the future will be by creating its own essence in reality.
What are you working on now?
Well, we're putting a lot of these bots together. So one thing I noticed is, you know, when the robots not only talk to people, but they could talk to each other. And when they're in a community, their personalities change. So one becomes more aggressive, one becomes shy and passive. And so I'm making something called a botanical garden, where these bots live on cell phones and react to each other.
Lynn Hirschman-Leeson is an artist and filmmaker. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. There's a new book out about Hirschman-Leeson's art. It's called The Art and Films of Lynn Hirschman-Leeson, Secret Agents, Private Eye.